From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
It contacted employers of targets and planted false and scurrilous rumors about them so they would be fired. It stopped people from speaking, writing, having outlets. And its most hideous attempt was the besmirching of the reputation of Martin Luther King.
It's been 30 years since the FBI's counterintelligence program went into full gear. We'll talk with a former FBI agent and hear from the late William Kunstler. Also, a last-minute stay of execution for death row prisoner Tommy Thompson. But will the Supreme Court uphold it? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. UPS workers walked off the job today, beginning a strike that will disrupt deliveries of documents and packages across the nation. The walkout by more than 185,000 members of the Teamsters Union is the first nationwide strike in the 90-year history of UPS, which delivers 12 million parcels and documents a day. UPS estimated that a scattered one-day walkout in 1994 cost it $50 million. The Atlanta-based company, which has 302,000 employees in the United States, will make medical and pharmaceutical supplies and other emergency deliveries its first priority, and also expects to keep up its international service. The Independent Pilots Association, which represents UPS's 2,000 pilots, said it will honor the Teamsters picket line. The two sides talked for a little over 2 hours last night, but Teamsters President Ron Carey said there's no progress and the talks were a waste of time. Their four-year contract expired midnight last Thursday. The union insisted upon limits on subcontracting and more full-time jobs. Nearly two-thirds of the Teamsters at UPS are part-timers. Another sticking point was the company's desire to withdraw from the Teamsters' multi-employer pension and health funds. UPS said it would improve its employees' pensions, but union officials said they told UPS that such a move would be a deal killer. The rival Federal Express Corporation had already reported a sharp increase in business in recent days and imposed limits, including cutting drop-off times by 2 hours, suspending money-back guarantees, and declining new regular accounts. The U.S. Postal Service announced temporary measures today, including limiting customers to four parcels a visit. Postmaster General Marvin Runyon said an extraordinary increase in volume is expected. Tensions remain high in the West Bank, where Israeli soldiers arrested 29 more Palestinians today in an early morning sweep. An army statement says they're suspects in hostile terrorist activity. Israel has arrested 145 Palestinians since the double suicide bombings in Jerusalem last week that killed 15 people, including the two bombers. Meanwhile, a drive-by shooting yesterday in the West Bank isn't making things easier. Newspaper reports say Israeli extremists are suspected in the fatal shooting of a Palestinian. U.S. Envoy Dennis Ross is expected to fly to Israel later in the week to try to get peace talks restarted. California's attorney general is moving swiftly to reinstate Tuesday's planned execution of Thomas Martin Thompson. A federal appeals court in San Francisco has blocked the death sentence, ruling that there are doubts over whether Thompson raped his victim. That would remove the special circumstance required for capital punishment. Thompson was set to receive a lethal injection early Tuesday for the 1981 murder of a Laguna Beach woman. Thompson says he's innocent, and his lawyers claim to have new evidence in the case. California State Attorney General Dan Lundgren's office has already appealed the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. Federal appeals court on Sunday blocked the execution of the man for a 1981 rape and murder, saying his lawyer's incompetence raised a grave question about his guilt. Thomas Thompson was scheduled to die just after midnight tonight. In its 7-4 decision, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals threw out Thompson's rape conviction and death sentence by overturning an earlier ruling by its own three-judge panel. The rape conviction was a special circumstance that enabled him to be sentenced to death. We'll have more on that later in the show. Andrew Cunanan's suicide halted one of the nation's most lurid cases of serial murder. But from New Jersey to Virginia to Texas, the slayings of as many as 30 gay men or transvestites, which activists believe are the work of five serial killers, remain unsolved. In some cases, investigators have been hindered by lack of resources and some allege lack of interest. Activists who track violent crimes against gay men and lesbians acknowledge some police departments, even the FBI, are beginning to reach out to the gay community to build trust and understanding. Other activists, however, remain frustrated and say it still takes pushing to get many officers to take seriously any crimes involving homosexual victims, even homicides. The Pentagon reportedly is reviewing how its Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy is applied. The Dallas Morning News says the review was undertaken after discharges for homosexuality reached a five-year high of 850 in 1996. A spokesman says the policy is not being reviewed, just its enforcement. Many gay men and lesbians say commanders continue to ask people about their sexual orientation and have instigated witch hunts against gay men and lesbians. The three men charged with smuggling deaf and mute Mexicans in Los Angeles into the United States and forcing them to hawk trinkets have been operating out of Los Angeles since at least 1995, officials say. A federal complaint alleges the deaf immigrants were ordered to sell cheap keychains and other wares in Los Angeles International Airport and elsewhere until they could be sent to the main operation in New York City. And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Roughly 30 years ago, the Federal Bureau of Investigation began what it called the Counterintelligence Program, or COINTELPRO, a vast national program that aimed to destroy left-wing and progressive political organizations emerging out of African American, Native American, and Latino communities. Also targeted were student and youth groups that challenged the Vietnam War and the economic structure of American society. The FBI launched major campaigns against Dr. Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, among others. Many in the Black Panther Party leadership were jailed and assassinated, as were many leading organizers of the American Indian Movement. We're joined today by my co-host Bernard White, who is a producer at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. We do the local morning show together at WBAI. And we're joined on the phone by Wesley Swearingen, formerly an FBI agent for 25 years and the author of FBI Secrets, an Agent's Exposé. It's published by South End Press. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Wesley Swearingen.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, as we look back over these three decades of the counterintelligence program and its aftermath, can you talk a little about how it got started?
Well, I guess it started from paranoia of the Communist Party. It originated on paper in 1956 because Hoover thought that the Communist Party was such a threat. And the purpose was to destroy the Communist Party. He used the word neutralize, but that's what it meant, was to just destroy it. And it was so successful that the FBI carried it over to other organizations and groups later on in years.
Now, when did it officially become called the Counterintelligence Program?
In 1956. Against the Communist Party, it was called COINTELPRO, Counterintelligence, COINTELPRO. And then it went on to include the Ku Klux Klan and then black organizations and what they called the New Left. No one ever defined the New Left. It was just newer than the Old Left, which was the old Communist Party, and the COINTELPRO against the Black Panther Party. So it started in 56 and went through officially until 1971, when it was discovered by a group of people who broke into an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, and they discovered some documents that had the COINTELPRO caption on it, and so the FBI had to discontinue that officially on paper.
You wrote a book entitled FBI Secrets, an Agent's Exposé. When did you realize that your role in the FBI was something that you were not proud of?
Well, I guess it began to grow in the late 50s, when I realized that the Cold War was more of a propaganda thing than reality. And then later on in the 60s, when the FBI was going after the Students for Democratic Society. It was really mainly a group of college students that wanted to reform. And we were continuing the same illegal acts against the Students for Democratic Society, and then later on the Weathermen, which was a radical offshoot of the Students for Democratic Society. And so it was something that just grew.
What are some of the things you did specifically?
Well, starting about 1952, I was ordered to conduct illegal break-ins against the Communist Party and homes of members of the Communist Party. And at that time, I thought that any day we could have World War III, so that didn't really bother me that much, although I knew that it was in violation of the Constitution, illegal searches. And when I got older, at that time I had just turned 24, 25, and I was young and naive and thought that everything the government did was correct and proper. I discovered later on that that wasn't true. So, it took me 10 or 15 years to really catch on to what the government was doing.
We're talking to Wesley Swearingen. He is author of FBI Secrets and Agents Exposé, and he was an FBI agent for 25 years.
Well, one of the people that, I guess your name came up quite a bit around a couple of weeks ago when Geronimo Pratt was released. What's your relationship to the Pratt case?
Well, when I was still in the FBI in Los Angeles, I was on the squad that investigated Geronimo Pratt, and he was being tried for murder in the summer of 1972, and I became aware that he was going to be set up just because he was the leader of the new leader in Los Angeles, of the Los Angeles chapter of the Black Panther Party. But I didn't think too much about it because I thought Charles Gary, who had been the attorney for Bobby Seale and Huey Newton, for Bobby Seale in Chicago and New Haven, and for Huey Newton in San Francisco, I felt that Charles Gary would be Geronimo Pratt's attorney. And I discovered later that Huey Newton had given orders to Charles Gary not to defend Geronimo Pratt, and that was primarily because of the FBI's COINTELPRO operation that they had going between Los Angeles and Oakland, trying to split the two chapters, and they did successfully split them. But Geronimo Pratt was convicted and went to prison. And when I retired in 1977, I got in touch with Charles Gary. And I wanted Charles Gary to help me bring different forms of FBI corruption to the attention of the Attorney General. And we attempted that, but it didn't work out too well.
You were in the courtroom, Wesley Swearingen, weren't you, when Geronimo Pratt was released?
Yes, I was. It was June 10th of this year.
And you had known for a long time that there was an informant, that Julius Baker, who was the chief witness against him, had been an informant for the police and the FBI, something that the defense and the jury didn't know and were the grounds for getting Geronimo Pratt out of prison.
Yes, that was Julius Butler.
Julius Butler, right.
Yes.
So how did it feel to see this man released on evidence that you had seen years ago?
Well, it felt great because I started to help Stuart Hanlon and Johnny Cochran back in about 1979. And I first told these two attorneys that Julius Butler, who had testified against Geronimo Pratt, was an FBI informant. And, of course, it was difficult for them to believe that the prime witness was an FBI informant. But I helped them get the documents, the FBI documents, to prove that Butler was an informant. And, you know, it took about 18 years of long, hard work. And so on June 10th, when Geronimo Pratt was actually released on bail, I didn't realize that it had bothered me that much all these years, and I actually did break down and wept right there in the courtroom, and that even surprised me.
From what we understand, that there were also tapes that were available that would show that Geronimo was not even in the same city when the woman was killed.
Yes, the FBI had paid for an illegal wiretap that the Oakland Police Department had on the Black Panther Party, and one of the recordings included a reference to a man by the name of G, and that's Geronimo Pratt used to go by G. And the Oakland Police Department knew that, and sort of the FBI knew that Geronimo Pratt was in Oakland, I think it was the day or the second day after that murder in Santa Monica that he was found guilty of.
I mean, he was head of the L.A. Black Panthers, right? And he said he was calling back from the leadership meeting he was at in Oakland of the Black Panthers, you know, always to the Los Angeles office, which was exactly what the FBI would be tapping.
Yes. And when I was still in the FBI, just before I retired, I was assigned the job of reviewing Freedom of Information requests. And the majority of them were concerning the Black Panther Party. And some of them were people well known, such as William Kunstler. And in my review in 1976 or 77, I don't know exactly when it was probably early 1977, that the FBI had a wiretap in Los Angeles for a period of about 3 weeks. And I couldn't find any logs for that time, which was unusual because the FBI kept logs on everything. And later on, when I got in touch with Stuart Hanlon and Johnny Cochran, I was going through some of the papers that had been released by the FBI, and I realized then what had probably happened, that there was this wiretap and the FBI destroyed the logs on Black Panther Party headquarters. And the only reason I could think of that is because that was documentary proof that Pratt was in Oakland at the time. Of course, the FBI denies this. And they also had denied that it was a wiretap that the Oakland Police Department had. And I think it was just a year ago, it was in 1996, that the FBI released to the Los Angeles County Prosecutor's Office documents indicating that Oakland Police Department did have a wiretap and that it was financed by the FBI.
Wesley Swearingen, we have to break, but we'd ask you to stay with us for a few more minutes after the break to tell us briefly about Thomas Sullivan, who is the assistant FBI director in charge of the counterintelligence program. And then we are going to hear from the late William Kunstler in a speech he gave about Thomas Sullivan, what happened to him, and what was the effects of the counterintelligence program. Wesley Swearingen is a former FBI agent, was with the Bureau for a quarter of a century. He's written a book called FBI Secrets and Agents Exposé. We'll be back on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In 60 seconds. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Bernard White, and our guest is Wesley Swearingen. He's author of FBI Secrets and Agents Exposé, and yes, he was an FBI agent for more than a quarter of a century.
Mm-hmm. For his last 10 years at the Bureau, William Sullivan was the chief of Domestic Intelligence Division and was responsible for COINTELPRO and died amidst some peculiar circumstances. Could you tell our listeners about what you know about William Sullivan?
Well, as you said, he was the director of the Domestic Intelligence Division for a number of years, and I think it was under Sullivan that the counterintelligence program was developed. At least, if he didn't originate it, he certainly did expand it. I know that. And he died under rather unusual circumstances. He was hunting near his home up in the Northeast, and he was killed by the son of a police officer in a hunting accident, and there was some question about the kind of clothing that he was wearing and so on, but I do know that the TASS news agency considered it an assassination. Of course, the FBI and local police and all the U.S. government officials said, no, it was just a hunting accident. It had nothing to do with the fact that Sullivan was about to testify before Congress on all the illegal activities that the FBI had done over the years.
Mm-hmm. We're going to hear in a few moments from William Kunstler, who also did some research on his murder. But I was wondering, what kind of personal relationship did you have with William Sullivan? What kind of person did you see him as?
He was short, kind of nondescript. I think he came from the Midwest, kind of a farm boy type. He read a lot, but he wasn't what a lot of people think of CEOs today in large corporations. He was frumpy type that, you know, his clothes always looked like he had slept in them, as opposed to some of the others that could be models for a Hollywood movie set.
William Kunstler believes that he was killed by the FBI. What do you think?
It is quite possible. That was my impression to begin with. so that Sullivan wouldn't tell Congress all the nasty things that the FBI had done.
Well, Wesley Swearengen, we're going to hear William Kunstler, who died actually 2 years ago, but who gave a speech on this subject before he died. And we're going to hear his analysis of what happened. But I want to thank you very much for joining us. Wesley Swearengen, 25-year FBI agent, has written a book called FBI Secrets and Agents Exposé. It's a book published by Southend Press. And Bernard White, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Amy.
As we go into this speech that William Kunstler gave. He's talking about William Sullivan, who was with the FBI for 30 years, forced out in 71 after a dispute with J. Edgar Hoover. And for his last 10 years at the Bureau, Sullivan was the chief of Domestic Intelligence Division, responsible for COINTELPRO. This was a speech given at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts on April 4th, 1978, about the FBI Deputy Director William Sullivan and his assassination.
In the investigation of all intelligence activities, the Church Committee, which bears the name of the Select Committee to Study Governmental Operations of the United States Senate with respect to intelligence activities, conducted hearings about COINTELPRO and issued reports. The Church Committee came to the conclusion that it was a sophisticated vigilante operation, intolerable in the democratic society, even if all of the targets involved had been involved in violent activity. The unexpressed major premise was that a law enforcement agency has the duty to do whatever is necessary to combat perceived threats to the existing social and political order. Any of you that have witnessed Holocaust know that that was also the doctrine of the SS, among others, in Nazi Germany. They used the techniques of wartime. And as Mr. Sullivan, who was in charge of it, testified before the Church Committee, no holds were barred. It had a 15-year life, if you believe it's over. It had 2,370 separate actions against groups. Some of the techniques used violated criminal statutes, such as incitement to murder, burglary, warrantless wiretapping, mail openings, interference with the tax returns and the judicial process, and so on. It also utilized techniques that involved a serious risk of bodily harm or death to its targets. And it was called by the Church Committee, all of these techniques were called as abhorrent in a free society. Among other things, the Bureau authored or planted articles about people. It sent anonymous letters to the spouses. If you had a white woman engaged in the civil rights movement, they sent a letter to her husband, written in pidgin English, that his old lady was sleeping around with black men, and vice versa, in order to disrupt marriages so as to disrupt political activities. It utilized a technique called snitch jacket, where they would label publicly that someone was an informer, thus opening that person to death or something short of that, or ostracism by the group involved. It encouraged street warfare between various groups, the Panthers and an organization called Us on the West Coast, the Nation of Islam, and Malcolm X's new group, the Organization of Afro-American Unity. It contacted employers of targets and planted false and scurrilous rumors about them so they would be fired. It stopped people from speaking, writing, having outlets. And its most hideous attempt was the besmirching of the reputation of Martin Luther King, which I'll get to in a moment. It had five domestic programs. From 1956 on, it had the program against the Communist Party USA. That was expanded in 1960 to the Socialist Workers Party, and so on and so forth, until it had every so-called Marxist group targeted. In 1964, it then included the Klan under a title White Hate Groups, and in 1967, Black Nationalist Hate Groups. By the way, it never utilized against the Klan.
what it has utilized against the so-called black nationalist hate groups, which included everything from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of Martin King, the NAACP, the Congress of Racial Equality, and all down the line. In November of 1968, it had a special program for the Black Panther Party, and the month before, for the New Left. Those were its domestic targets. The Martin Luther King case study, which occupies a separate place in this book, was an action brought against Martin King, which the Bureau now says were unjust and improper. Mr. Sullivan called him the most dangerous Negro leader in the country. And everything was done, including, I think, to assassinate him, to destroy this man. Mr. Sullivan recommended most of the measures against Dr. King, and they were beyond description in their hideousness. Among other things, we had the wiretaps of virtually every hotel room he stayed in, of the New York office and the Atlanta office of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. We had the attempt to discredit him with everybody, from the Pope, when Martin was to have a meeting with the Pope, the FBI planted material in diplomatic pouches that went to the Vatican, to discredit him with church officials in the United States, with funding organizations who gave grants and donations to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, to terrify people who might support it, to do everything possible to make Dr. King look like a charlatan and a mountebank. They had his tax returns audited year after year. Nothing was ever found, but that was an intimidating device. They contacted religious leaders throughout the United States, members of Congress, the White House. And worst of all, they circulated some tapes, which they said were bedroom tapes of Dr. King, which was sent to the White House and to many other places. They devised a plan to promote a new black leader, someone they could control more readily, in his place. They unloaded the full wrath of COINTELPRO on this man. And of probably the worst from a sensibility point of view, they sent tapes to Mrs. King. And they sent a letter. They were mailed to her from Miami by an agent who took them from Mr. Sullivan's hands, flew to Miami, where they would have a southern postmark, and mailed them to Mrs. King. There was a letter which accompanied them sent to Dr. King, which was a letter inviting him to commit suicide, or the tapes would be revealed. And he was told to commit suicide within 34 days, or the tapes would be revealed. The reason they took 34 days was on the 35th day, Martin was to receive the Nobel Peace Prize in Stockholm, and they didn't want that to happen. I'll read you the letter which was sent, and it was written in handwriting which no one could identify. King, look into your heart. You know you are a complete fraud and a greater liability to all of us Negroes, as if it came from a black person. White people in this country have enough frauds of their own, but I'm sure they don't have one at this time that is anywhere near your equal. You are no clergyman, and you know it. I repeat that you are a colossal fraud and an evil, vicious one at that. King, like all frauds, your end is approaching. You could have been our greatest leader, but you are done. Your honorary degrees, your Nobel Prize, and other awards will not save you. King, I repeat, you are done. The American public, the church organizations that have been helping, Protestant, Catholics, and Jews will know you for what you are, an evil beast. So will others who have backed you. You are done. King, there is only one thing left for you to do. You know what it is. You have just 34 days in which to do it. You are done. There is but one way out for you. You better take it before your filthy, fraudulent self is bared to the nation. Mr. Sullivan was killed 15 minutes before sunrise on November 9th, 1977. Sun rises on that day at 6:31 a.m. Hunting in New Hampshire is forbidden until a half hour before sunrise and a half hour after sunset, because those are the areas in which it is light from 6 o'clock on that particular day to whatever a half hour after sunset was. So it was light when he was killed. He was shot from, to take the killer's description, 243 feet away. The investigators place it much closer. He was shot in a backyard of a home from a maximum of 243 feet away. That is three quarters of a football field. He was shot with a 30.06 Remington rifle, very high-powered rifle, the same rifle, same type that killed Martin Luther King. It was equipped with a sniper sight, a three-scope sight, three-power sight, which enlarges everything three times. He was wearing a red and black Mackinaw when he was shot, a hunter's Mackinaw. The authorities gave out the information that Mr. Sullivan was wearing a white turtleneck sweater. The man who examined the body told the investigator there was no such sweater on his body. There was no white showing at all. The only white he wore that day was a T-shirt under a buttoned green shirt that you couldn't see, and the red and black Mackinaw and a brown hat. So there was no white to be the white tail of a deer at all. My investigator was told by one of the investigators of the incident that in his opinion, Mr. Sullivan was murdered, and that if my investigator, because we know his name, if my investigator revealed that, he would deny he ever said it. He said, I have to live up here, and I cannot afford to have that brooded about. I might add, in motivation, one other thing came to mind, that Mr. Sullivan was also a defendant in three major lawsuits against the FBI, brought by the National Lawyers Guild, the Black Panther Party, and the Socialist Workers Party. And it is highly conceivable he would have told the same story which would have won those lawsuits for those three organizations. So here we have something which I think everybody in this audience must say looks, if anything, suspicious. This is as massive a cover-up as Watergate, and more so, because involved in this is the murder of a president, the murder of a civil rights leader, the murder of Malcolm X, all of which are inextricably tied up with the Bureau. The Malcolm X story has just been reopened by a state judge in New York because, among other things, the key witness to the killing, who spirited away one of the murder weapons and then turned himself into the FBI, was hidden by the Bureau throughout the entire trial of the three men who were accused of the murder, even though it was he who shot one of the assassins and enabled him to be captured. Someone you would say was certainly a key witness. It's this same man whom the Bureau files reveal the day after Malcolm's death was seen passing $100 bills out throughout Harlem. There isn't the slightest doubt in my mind that that murder was engineered by the Bureau in order to create the enmity and street warfare that it did create between the Nation of Islam and the Organization of Afro-American Unity, which was Malcolm's group when he split. The murder of Martin Luther King, you try to think of one motive that would clue you into the killing of Dr. King and the person who was supposed to have done that killing. Try to think of one thing that would say, yes, that man had a motive to do it. James Earl Ray. And you know there is no motive and has never been a motive. And of course, that case went without a jury trial. as well, without any trial at all. The Bureau did it and arranged for it. And the Bureau arranged for the murder of Malcolm X, and the Bureau arranged in some way for the murder of William Cornelius Sullivan.
The late William Kunstler, speaking in 1978 at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, about what he says is the assassination of the former FBI Deputy Director William Sullivan, who was in charge of the counterintelligence program. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and if you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal appeals court in California this weekend blocked the execution of Thomas Martin Thompson for a 1981 rape and murder. The court said that his lawyer's ineptness raised grave questions about Thompson's guilt. The state of California can appeal the decision. Thompson was scheduled to be executed tonight at midnight by lethal injection at San Quentin. Before this last-minute stay, Thompson's case attracted attention nationwide because seven former prosecutors, including the author of the California death penalty statute, filed court papers opposing Thompson's execution. They said they had doubts about his guilt. Despite the support, Governor Pete Wilson denied Thompson clemency late last week. We're joined on the phone now by Ron Lowe, who is deputy press secretary for Governor Wilson. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello, Amy. How are you?
Good. Well, can you tell us what's going to happen now? The federal appeals court has blocked the execution, but you, in fact, the governor and the state of California is appealing this to the Supreme Court?
Right. As soon as the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal blocked the execution last night, the Attorney General of California filed an appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court. Monday morning, the court is scheduled to hear a brief on this, and we are confident that the Supreme Court is going to reverse this 11th-hour effort by this liberal clique of the Ninth Circuit. Governor Wilson had the opportunity to review all the documentation, over 3,000 pages of documentation, when Thomas Thompson asked the governor for clemency. After reviewing over 3,000 pages of court testimonies, of transcripts, of materials submitted by Mr. Thompson's attorneys, the prosecution, and also having a two-hour meeting with Mr. Thompson's attorneys and the prosecution, he concluded that there is no new evidence and that, in fact, Mr. Thompson is guilty of the rape and murder.
You referred to a liberal clique that is reversing this decision, or at least ruled on a stay of execution. But what about the seven former prosecutors, including the author of the California death penalty statute, who felt that he should not be executed, that Tommy Thompson should not be executed?
I mean, if you take a look at it, there actually are not seven former prosecutors. There are some, there's one or two former prosecutors, and the rest of them are defense attorneys, and their arguments were written by Mr. Thompson's counsel. Again, I mean, the governor did take that into consideration, that these individuals did, you know, write to the Board of Prison Terms and to the governor saying that Mr. Thompson should be given clemency. But the fact of the matter is the governor takes the clemency issue very seriously, and he bases it on fact, the fact of court transcripts, you know, the fact of materials submitted by both sides. And it's not something based on someone's written into the governor saying that someone should be spared or someone should be given clemency. He does this based on the facts of the case.
There were two trials, in fact. There was the trial of Tommy Thompson, and he was convicted of the rape and murder in 1981. And then there is also the trial of David Leitch. Is that how it's pronounced, Leitch?
Yes.
And David Leitch was sentenced to something like 15 years to life, is that right, also for the murder. But when he was tried, the prosecution did not argue that Tommy Thompson had raped the victim. And that's what you needed for a death penalty sentence. You also needed a rape in addition to the murder.
You needed a special circumstance.
Right.
To qualify for the death penalty.
But when the prosecution tried David Leitch, at whose behest it looks like, if the prosecution is going to carry its theory through, Tommy Thompson was working for, they did not argue that Tommy Thompson had raped the woman. They had argued a whole other theory.
That's correct. I mean, I wasn't at the court, or I wasn't at the 83 proceedings for David Leitch. You know, I don't know why the Orange County District Attorney prosecuted that way, but again, the governor feels that David Leitch should have received a stronger sentence for the case, and he thinks that he got off too lightly for 15 years to life.
So right now, you are hoping, or at least the governor is hoping, that in fact Tommy Thompson's case will go to the Supreme Court and that they will overturn the federal appeals court decision and that he will be killed on schedule just after midnight tonight.
That is correct, and the fact is that the defense isn't raising new evidence, but it's only repackaging the lies of Thomas Thompson. This is a man who failed his own lie detector test. The people of California, and more importantly, the victim's family, should not have to wait any longer for justice to be served. He's had his day in court. He has squandered it by feeding the jury lies and contradictions when he's testified. And Ginger Fleischley's death sentence, you know, arrived within hours of her encounter with Mr. Thompson. By contrast, Mr. Thompson has had more than 16 years of life since he committed this crime. In the 16 years, his case has been litigated up and down, you know, the court system. And we believe that, you know, he committed this heinous crimes which mets out the death penalty, and we believe that the Supreme Court should reverse the action of the Ninth Circuit and allow the execution to proceed as scheduled.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us. We've been speaking with Ron Lowe, who is Deputy Press Secretary for California Governor Pete Wilson. And again, the news there is that the governor, through the Attorney General Dan Lundgren, is appealing the federal appeals court decision to stay the execution of Tommy Thompson. They're hoping that this execution will continue as scheduled tonight, just after midnight. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We're now going to go to an attorney, Robert Bryan, a San Francisco attorney specializing in death penalty litigation and former chair of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. We're sorry we couldn't have Ron Lowe on with Robert Bryan, but he didn't want to go on with an opposing attorney. Robert Bryan, can you summarize this case for us and why you feel so strongly that Tommy Thompson should not be executed tonight?
Well, this case raises the question as to whether any of us should feel comfortable with capital punishment, aside from the moral question, and that is, in the Thompson case, we have a very strong likelihood that an innocent person will be executed, and that's troubling even for the most staunch advocates for the death penalty. The prosecution, as you pointed out in your questions to Governor Wilson's press secretary, argued, I'll use the words of the U.S. Court of Appeals to the Ninth Circuit, flagrantly inconsistent theories in two separate trials. In Mr. Thompson's trial, the condemned inmate's trial, they argued that he had raped this woman and then killed her to cover up the rape. In the trial of the co-defendant, who only was convicted of second-degree murder, they argued a completely different and inconsistent theory. In the Thompson case, they argued that that only Mr. Thompson was present at the time of the killing. In the co-defendant's trial, they argued that the co-defendant was there and involved in the killing. And this is very unsettling that even the prosecution would have such, again, these words of the court, flagrant disregard for the truth. Both theories cannot be right. And it is very troubling. And we need to realize that what has happened in the Thompson case has happened time and time again in cases throughout the history of this country and its history of executing people, that from time to time, innocent people do get executed. This does happen in our country, regardless of how many safeguards are in place, in any case, through the appellate process.
We're talking to Robert Bryan, San Francisco attorney, who was formerly the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty chair. I'm looking at a piece by Michael Kroll, who writes for Pacific News Service. And he says that Ginger Feisley was stabbed 5 times in the head with a single-edged knife. David Leitch, Thompson's co-defendant and his roommate for 3 weeks, was Feisley's boyfriend until shortly before the murder. He owned a single-edged knife, and unlike Thompson, he had a long record of violence against women, including 3 prior assaults with a knife. Less than 2 weeks before she was killed, Fleischley had called the police and reported that Leitch had threatened to kill her. Was this brought up in Tommy Thompson's trial, the violence of her former boyfriend who had actually threatened to kill her just before, and the fact that it was his knife that was used?
Probably, because this even brings out another point about our legal process, that we make mistakes, that trials are not perfect. And when facts are missed, when things are not brought out, when mistakes occur, then sometimes the consequence can be quite horrible. In this case of a very likely an innocent person being executed. And the trial was replete with error, and that was another basis for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit reversing the rape conviction yesterday, Sunday, was that defense counsel in the Thompson trial had made some substantial errors, which, again, the court felt it left one with some doubt as to the right reliability of his conviction and certainly the death sentence.
Robert Bryan, why does this all just come out now in the last 12 hours before Tommy Thompson is killed, or in the last 72 hours this weekend?
Well, it's coming out publicly to the knowledge of we and the general public, but some of this has been argued for years. I think it says something about our legal process and how harum-scarum it is. The Ninth Circuit last year had this case, I believe in March of this year, in just a 3-judge panel, reversed the lower federal court and said, in effect, that Mr. Thompson should die, should be executed. Now we have a panel representing the entire court, an 11-judge panel, who in a 7-4 decision yesterday reversed that. Our legal system is good, but it has a lot of imperfections. And we talk about errors, mistakes that occur at the trial level. They also occur on the post-conviction and appeal process. And it's confusing to the public. Believe me, it's confusing for people like me who specialize in death penalty litigation. It's almost like a roll of the dice as to what will happen when a court reviews a case such as this, which, again, is troubling because judges are just like the rest of us. They make mistakes, and this decision yesterday is so logical. It's a very lengthy decision about the errors in Thompson's case, inconsistent theories, the incompetence, mistakes of trial counsel. That it seems to be a very good decision, but the process is sometimes baffling, as I said, even to we who deal with it all the time.
Again, we're talking to Robert Bryan, San Francisco attorney specializing in death penalty litigation, talking about the Tommy Thompson case tonight. Tommy Thompson, who was scheduled to die right after midnight. Now there's been a stay of his execution. The case will go to the Supreme Court. Where does California stand in terms of death penalty cases? How many prisoners are on death row?
Well, California has the largest death row in the United States. We're approaching 500 now. It's well over 400. There are approximately 6,000 now on death row throughout the United States, but we in California do have the dubious distinction of having the largest death row, and then behind us, not too far back, are Texas and Florida. We certainly do not have the largest number in modern times of executions, but we certainly have the largest death row. And what it means is that we, of course, most of us are aware of the extraordinarily high number of executions in Texas. And unless things change, eventually we're going to get to that point here in California of almost assembly line execution of fellow human beings. And our death row is growing here in California at an alarming rate. I was in the visiting room over at San Quentin's death row this past Friday, and I'm over at least once, often twice a week over there. And I was just thinking as I sat there how crowded that visiting room was, how much more crowded it was than even a year ago. It's so big now, the death row at San Quentin, that they have to terminate loved ones who visit death row inmates usually after they're there an hour and a half or sometimes even an hour, because it becomes so crowded they have to make room for other visitors to see other death row inmates.
Well, Robert Bryan, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Robert Bryan, former chair of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, a San Francisco attorney who specializes in death penalty litigation. And we'll let our listeners know tomorrow the outcome of the decision on the fate of Tommy Thompson, death row prisoner in California. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And I want to thank all the people who called in after our show on Friday about Scientology. We got calls, we got email, and we wanted to play some of the comments for you. But before I do that, let me read an email. It says, thank you for the piece you did on the cult of Scientology on Friday. My wife and I were involved for almost 20 years, and I can vouch for everything your guest said about the destructiveness of the methods used. A year ago, I spoke to a reporter at the Washington Post who has reported on Scientology, and he told me the media in the U.S. is very unwilling to do articles exposing the cult, since doing so invariably results in exhaustive harassment, both legal and illegal. The internet is one of the few places in the U.S. that the truth about Scientology is available, and the cult has gone to unbelievable lengths to suppress free speech on the internet, including raids on critics and seizures of equipment and documents. This is a story in itself. But not everyone felt that way about Friday's show.
My name is Bill Moon. I'm in L.A. As a Scientologist, I'm practicing Scientologist for like 20-some years. I really resent this unauthorized, blanket denigration of my religion.
And my name is Keith Atkinson. I'm in Los Angeles, California, and was driving to my office this morning, listening, as I always do, to Democracy Now! On Pacifica Radio, and heard your segment on the Scientologists. I must tell you, I am not a Scientologist, but I have worked with them here in the city of Los Angeles now for about 5 years. In regards to those with whom I work here in Los Angeles, I found your show to be very distorted and to present a terrible misperception.
This is Reverend Glenn Barton of the Church of Scientology in Los Angeles. I just listened to your program, Democracy Now!, with host Amy Goodman and her guests, Jim Siegelman and Flo Conway, and I have never heard a more inaccurate, hyperbole-filled mess of trash about my church than this is unbelievable.
Well, I want to thank everyone who has called in. They're talking about the conversation we had on Friday with Flo Conway and Jim Siegelman, authors of Snapping, America's Epidemic of Sudden Personality Change. Tomorrow, we will continue our discussion on Scientology, and we will be joined by some of the people who called us. We'll be joined by a Scientologist as well as non-Scientologists debating the issue. If you'd like to join in the discussion, you can also call us on our comment line. We'll play some of those comments tomorrow, whatever experience you've had with Scientology. The number to call is 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. Or you can write to us by email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with help from Leslie George and Janice K. Bryant. Errol Maitland is our engineer. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!